Our second scripture reading today comes from the book of Luke, chapter 6, verses 27 to 38. Listen now for the word of God. But I say to you that listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies. Do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. Holy wisdom, holy word. Thanks be to God. Now, on the Voice of America website, Talia Hadabi tells the story of Phyllis Rodriguez, whose son Greg died in the World Trade Center on 9/11. She said, "Many Americans felt the need to retaliate after the terrorist attacks on the United States in 2001. And ever since then, U.S. forces have waged a worldwide war against the Islamic extremists who claimed responsibility. But not all Americans seek retribution to ease their pain." Phyllis Rodriguez is one mother who expresses forgiveness, not hate, towards those who killed her son 10 years ago on September 11th. Greg was a computer specialist working on the 103rd floor of the North Tower, and we know that was above where the airplane hit. She recalls how she found out that something terrible had happened that Tuesday morning. She said, "On our answering machine was a message from Greg, our son, that said, 'There's been a terrible accident at the World Trade Center. I'm okay. Call Elizabeth,'" who was his wife. Sadly, Greg Rodriguez was not okay, and neither were 3,000 others. She said, "I was just hoping that he had survived and not allowing myself to admit the worst," recalled his mother. That news came soon enough, though, when Greg Rodriguez was declared dead. And with it came his parents' conscious decision to make a difference. The main thing that we realized very early the morning of the 12th is that our government, giving its history, was going to do something military and violent in retaliation in the name of our son. And that wasn't going to do any good, and we didn't support it. So Phyllis Rodriguez and her husband Orlando released an open letter to then President George W. Bush, and it ended up being circulated around the country and around the world. "It was part of the way to help us cope with the loss," she said. "The couple wanted no part in revenge." They opposed the death penalty also for the man who became known as the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Massawi. Phyllis actually befriended Zacharias's mother. She said, "I felt that this woman has to be very, very courageous because her son is the most hated person right now, probably at this moment in the world. And here she was standing up for her son. We realized we had in common our common humanity. We were both human beings and both mothers. Our friendship has become a very valuable part of my life and my healing." Rodriguez says she is disappointed by the way the U.S. government has used the war on terror in her son's name. She said, "I felt terrible sorrow at all the losses over time, all the bereft families. We had the whole world in sympathy with us at the time it happened. We could have been leaders and working for world peace and peace in the Middle East. And what did we do? We blew it." Phyllis Rodriguez says she copes with the loss of her only son by opposing war and participating in human rights and forgiveness projects. "I don't think it happened for a reason," she said, "but it did happen. And I feel fortunate that I had the faith resources to respond in the way that I did." Rodriguez says she is at peace about what happened to her son now, but she's not at peace with the state of the world. That is why she says she is trying to make a difference for peace. Now, today's passage contains the concluding words of Jesus' Sermon on the Plain that I preached about last Sunday. And I connected the wabi-sabi Japanese philosophy for humble, peaceful living with what Jesus was proposing in this sermon. And I have the book up here if anyone wants to see it after the service. It's Japanese Wisdom for a Perfectly Imperfect Life. And Bill Nakata, who was here last Sunday, he isn't here today, but he ran home actually and got a book that he had read many years ago called Ikigai. And it's also a very wabi-sabi philosophy from Japan. And it was a New York Times bestseller. And so I have that book now in my office. And as you work through it, it has a whole chapter at the very end about wabi-sabi and the importance of going with the flow of life and trying to accept things that happen as imperfection, just the way life is. Now, this Sermon on the Plains, it sums up Christ's teaching of the way for us to be in this world. That's why they called his followers at that time people of the way, because Christ was teaching the way we all should be in the world. And it is also the agenda for God's kingdom. Some people have called it the agenda that God has for God's kingdom. It gives those who follow Jesus a foundational philosophy to understand his further teachings and actions. So if you took all the good advice from the wise sages over the many years about how to live an authentic and ethical life, and if you boiled them all down to the real essentials, you would hear echoes from this Sermon on the Plain. Jesus explains his agenda of love and mercy. And when Jesus commands his followers to love your enemies, he doesn't just leave it in an abstract way. He tells us exactly how to accomplish it. He said, "If we love our enemies, we do good to them. Bless and pray for those who abuse you." But this is not a warm and fuzzy feeling kind of love. This is a difficult kind of love for enemies, but it's transformative, and it has to be very intentional. It not only has the potential to heal the enemy, but it also heals oneself when you're in the process of doing it. His command to bless those who curse you reminds me of when Michelle Obama said, "When they go low, we go high." She said, "Don't be tempted to call people names or speak evil of them when they are speaking evil of you. Take the higher ground and demonstrate with your words and actions what kind of person you are." And Bishop Desmond Tutu is also a great role model for this. And he said, "Love your enemy. It will ruin his reputation." He's got such a great sense of humor. Jesus would want you to defend yourself, though, from physical harm. He doesn't want you to just lay down and let yourself get beat up, but not retaliate in the same way. Retaliate with love. When we show calm restraint, we are showing God's strength. And I don't know if you all remember, I told this story when I was in elementary school of my friend Susan, who used to get teased for having a big nose. And one day, some of the kids decided to gang up on Susan and had her kind of cornered in the part of the playground. And I went over and I said, "What are you doing?" You know, and they're like, "Oh, you know, we're making fun of Susan." And they started hitting her on the back. And I put my arm around her and we sat down and they made a circle around us. And every time they went on the back of us, they would hit us on the back. And I remember just putting my arm around Susan and we put our heads down and we just let them do that. And after a while, they stopped. And I thought, you know, I'm going to run and tell the teacher. And then I thought, no, I'm not going to run and tell the teacher. I don't know why I didn't, because I normally probably would have. And they never did it again. They never even bullied Susan again. And so it kind of mystified me as a kid, too, that just like coming around and being with someone who's getting bullied and showing strength in that way made a difference in that situation. So God, I think, was trying to teach me a lesson back then, too, because with three older brothers, you know, I could sometimes imagine myself being rough with people who were being mean. And so I think it was a good lesson for me to see how that worked. It helps to pray for your enemies, and one way is to figure out what common ground you have with them. Like this mother, Rodriguez, who thought about this other woman being the mother of this terrible, terrible man. So think about how you, though, are a flawed human as they are, but probably in different ways. And one of the things that helps me be patient with people is to think they must have had a difficult childhood. That's And I've heard people go up to others, too, that they're having trouble with and say, "Who hurt you?" You know, they could see that something was really a response to someone hurting them in the past. But have you ever been scared and anxious? I think all of us have been scared and anxious. And a lot of this bad behavior comes out of being scared and anxious. And so think about, what are our common fears? Do they love their family too and their children just like you do? There's still things that we have in common. And most of us deep down really do want peace and security and a purposeful life. We all have that same goal. Pray both for justice and for the hearts of those committing injustices. If you have hate in your heart, pray, "God, I hate that person and I don't want to." C.S. Lewis has said, "Prayer doesn't change God, prayer changes me," he said. So praying for your enemy opens you up to the work of the Holy Spirit in your own heart. To forgive your enemies, it helps too to remember Christ's words from the cross, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." When relatives of the victims in the South Carolina church shooting offered forgiveness to the young man who murdered their loved ones, they were taking the words of Jesus very seriously. Loving your enemy does not mean you have to add them to your Christmas list, though, or make them your best friend. It doesn't mean you excuse their actions. It means you forgive them with the knowledge that God is both merciful and just. Pray for a way to repay injury with blessing and respond to hate with love. The truth is that enemies bring only toxic emotions. If you're truly to live a prosperous life, you can't carry hate baggage around with you. Mahatma Gandhi drew great inspiration from Jesus' teachings, especially from this part of his sermon concerning doing good to evil. This sermon on the plain became an important source for developing his philosophy of nonviolence. So Martin Luther King said, Gandhi was probably the first person in history to lift the love ethic of Jesus up above mere interaction between individuals and turn it into a powerful and effective social force. Gandhi believed in six principles. There's more power in giving than receiving. There's more power in sacrifice than in greed. We must hate the sin but not the sinner. Love your enemy but not his ways. Love can be an alkaline to poison. Love can detoxify. Always leave room for reconciliation and redemption. And Gandhi was also fond of saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth leaves us blind, disfigured, and ugly. Greed and fear creates enemies. And Jesus says, perfect love casts out fear. Fear no man. Love is the unifying force in the universe. Freedom from fear disarms the oppressor. Love, fearlessness, and faith puts you in this other zone of consciousness that has no fear. And Nelson Mandela, after 27 years in jail in South Africa, is another great example. He said, forgiveness liberates the soul. It removes fear. That is why it's such a powerful weapon. And then he also said, as I walked out the door towards freedom, I knew that if I did not leave all the anger, hatred, and bitterness behind, that I would still be in prison. Thomas Christensen says that Christ's command to love our enemies, though, is the most unreasonable command Jesus gave. He said it seems impossible at times. And yet, it's important to remember all circumstances. We are dealing with humans, and humans are God's special creation. And when dealing with humans, we can have hope. Hope that messages of love and acceptance and peace can be heard. Hope that God can redeem even the worst of sinners. Hope that God can redeem our own deep, dark sins too. And when we treat our adversaries as humans, no matter how flawed, we hope that ultimate justice will prevail. We cling on to this belief that God will eventually make all the wrongs right, because that's God's job. So as Miroslav Volf said in his book, Exclusion and Embrace, if you want justice and nothing but justice, you will eventually get injustice. But if you want justice without injustice, you must want love. So let's see a video now of an example of how this is working as people contemplate
hurts, prison. Then justice should heal. That's Fania Davis. It makes sense, right? Unfortunately, that's not what we're doing. In the US, there are 2.2 million people behind bars and nearly 5 million on probation and parole in a system of mass incarceration laden with racial injustices that disproportionately affect minority communities. One out of every 14 children has a parent in prison, destroying the health, stability, and resources of entire communities. This is the retributive justice system, and it operates on the theory that punishing people for crime makes them stop. It's hugely expensive, destructive to the human spirit, and worst of all, it doesn't work. Psychiatrist James Gilligan even calls it the most powerful stimulant of violence that we've yet discovered. People are looking for another system. Fortunately, there is one. It's called restorative justice. It focuses less on punishing the crime and more on holding people accountable in order to heal the harm. Restorative justice is based on who we really are. We're designed to live in community, to be of service to one another, and to nurture and repair our relationships. Where the retributive system asks, who did it, what rule was broken, and how do we punish them? Restorative justice asks, what is the harm? Who has been harmed? How do we repair it? Here's how it works. All the stakeholders get a chance to be heard in a facilitated process that balances the needs of victims, offenders, and the community. The person harmed explains how he or she was hurt. This itself is healing as it meets the need for acknowledgement, validation, and repair. The person who did the harm is held accountable in a new way. They're also given the opportunity to accept responsibility for their actions, which is also healing, share their perspectives, and to make amends for the harm they caused in the relationships that were broken. The whole community has a chance to address the underlying problems that gave rise to the situation, and then everyone works together to find a way to restore balance and offer healing to all stakeholders. In restorative and community justice, the concept of beloved community and living in right relationship is key. You're restoring justice and just relationships within the whole community. Does it work? Well, look at this. In the prison system, wherever restorative justice is tried, recidivism has plummeted. In schools, switching to restorative justice drops suspension, improving students' educational and social well-being, while reducing bullying and other manifestations of violence. And it costs next to nothing by comparison. One teacher said, "Every time I used the retributive system, I lost a relationship. Every time I use this new system, I gain one." Restorative justice is justice that works, justice that transforms, justice that heals. Now that sounds like something we all want more of in our communities, so spread the word in yours.